I don't choose ideas to write about because they're ideas that are in white space or I can see can be positioned. I write about the things that I know my clients need.
My name is Bethany Saltman, and I am an author and a best-selling book coach.
And I'm Fran Hauser. I'm an author, a keynote speaker, and a publishing strategist. These How I Did It conversations will inspire listeners to claim their own authority mindset and turn the story they can't stop telling into a book the world needs to read.
This is Bookbound, the podcast, created in partnership with Share Your Genius. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Bookbound. I'm thrilled for you to hear from Pam Slim, award-winning author, speaker, and leader of the Keh Business Lab in Mesa, Arizona. She's actually authored 3 books, and the latest, The Widest Net, won Best Sales and Marketing Book of 2021 from Porchlight Books. Pam herself is a very special business coach whose root mission is to support entrepreneurs, and she's been at it for 3 decades. Talk about authority. This conversation is really special because we don't just dive into her author story, but we get to tap into her business savvy as well. It was such an interesting conversation, so I hope you enjoy. Hey, Pam.
Hello there.
So good to see you. I would love to talk to you about your beautiful phrase, body of work. You use that phrase to describe a person's evolving creative life as opposed to a career or a job or even a book. So since you have done so much work, so much varied work in your life, I'm really curious how you have discovered a book within the midst of your vast body of work. So how could you tell when a book was calling to you?
It's funny you use that language because that's pretty much exactly how it feels to me. I always describe myself as an author practitioner. So my books have always come from the work that I have done. And starting with the first one, Escape from Cubicle Nation, came from starting as a blogger when that was a thing.
Yep.
Back in 2005.
We remember.
So
yep.
The way that I experience it is because of the work that I have done for many years, a couple decades now as a coach. When I'm working with people is often where I figure out places where they're stuck, and then I figure out different, you know, frameworks and different ways to help them and begin to see insights or patterns or all those kinds of things. And then it literally is like I can begin to hear a book calling me. It sounds sort of cosmic, and because it is. Like I can just feel it. It's like I almost feel this presence that at first is super hazy, somewhere in the distance in the woods calling me. And then usually it's over time, it's something just begins to kind of shift in me where I'm like, I think this is more than a blog post and or a class. And I think it's actually something that's a book. And so it's usually every 7 to 10 years so far that happens.
I love that.
I've written 3 books.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. And can you tell us a little bit more about that first book? How did you go from blogger to book author?
That was actually a blog to book deal where my publisher, now Penguin Random House, but Penguin Portfolio, found me through my blog, actually through my podcast. So I had an Escape from Cubicle Nation podcast starting in, I think, 2006. And that was very, like, I think I did it on the phone. Remember those days we had the technology? It was like you talking to the phone with somebody and it records as a podcast. So my editor, Emily Rappaport, shout out to her, said that she was listening to my podcast on the train on the way into the city. And she became interested in my work. She visited my blog and then she approached me to do a book. So it was one of those emails. I had gone out in 2006, I think I had had my viral moment when Guy Kawasaki posted one of my blog posts on his blog because I sent him a link to it. Mm-hmm. It was the first time that we met and it was just a huge viral moment. So I actually had had somebody who introduced me to their agent and we had taken out the book. I had put together a very basic proposal, not really knowing what I was doing, and tried to shop it around a little bit and got resoundingly rejected. And one publisher was like, this is sort of a pedestrian idea, you know? So I just sort of slunk back to my keyboard and kept writing for another 18 months until I got an email that, you know, one would think it's a joke. It's like, wait a minute. Cause actually Portfolio was my preferred publisher. They did Guy's book, Seth Godin, a whole bunch of people who I knew and respected, but it was real. And it turns out they were the publisher that said my book was pedestrian. So sometimes it just takes a little bit longer to work on an idea to make it stick.
That's incredible. Wow. Okay. So that's the dream. You had the dream come true.
I did. I feel very lucky, which is why whenever people are asking me advice about, you know, pitching initially, we can talk about it because I did two books with Portfolio. And then the last one I went out to market, which is a whole different story than when somebody approaches you. But it's, I'm very, very thankful for it.
That's incredible. Well, you did a lot of work leading up to that, clearly.
Actually, I'd love to hear more about how you got your third book deal then. So this was for The Widest Net.
Yes.
So for that, it sounds like you actually did go out. You went through the process. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the deal that I had with Portfolio was for two books and, you know, the option. So it, Escape from Cubicle Nation was the first, Body of Work was the second. And so I did go to them with the third. And they, at that point, just didn't feel like it was a big enough idea or a good fit. And this is where I'd love to dig into one of the realities of, I feel great that my books have had really wonderful critical reception. Probably the most important thing for me is I know that they've really made an impact in individuals' lives, because I've gotten lots of emails through the years and know that they've been helpful for people. But I am not a, you know, Brené Brown selling millions of books of Dan Pink, you know, who has the numbers behind me. And so it really was a business decision that was honestly kind of personally painful, just because I'm such a relationship person. Mm-hmm. I had many delusions, even after having been in the market for a long time. And I work with tons of authors as well in my role as a business coach and advisor. Mm-hmm. I think I just wasn't fully understanding that my agent was trying to tell me how important it was first to really just have like a full-blown proposal. I'm going to give a shout out to my friend David Muldauer, who I ended up hiring to work on my proposal after we unsuccessfully gave a run for Portfolio. And he said, never take a meeting without a full proposal. Don't do it. And I was like, you clearly don't know me, David. Like, come on now. I'm like good friends. I've been friends with so many authors. I've written a million blurbs. I've done all the things to be a good partner. But he was 100% right. I didn't do justice to the idea in the book by not really giving it a full proposal treatment. So it was very painful, but an exceptionally important lesson that a book needs an extremely strong proposal. If we're not willing to put in the work as advocates for the ideas in our book to really demonstrate the big idea. Now, was I a little bit happy, aka gloating, when it won best small business on sales and marketing book of 2021? I was like, it wasn't a big idea, huh? You know, I mean, that was like, it was good. But they were 100% right to reject the idea, I think, in the way that I had proposed it and given my sales history. So that's the book biz, especially for the big publishers.
So when you think about the book proposal that you ended up writing, what part of that proposal do you think was the strongest, the most compelling? Like, what do you think really like sold the publisher, who was McGraw-Hill, right, for your third book? What feedback did you get from them? Or what part of the proposal were you the most proud of?
I think it was really the idea of the book itself. So it was, they were specifically interested in the idea. And I think just the way that it was juxtaposing the basic premise of the work is really looking at business development through the lens of ecosystem and collaboration partnership, as opposed to building empires, which I find most business books are really centered in this empire model of just making you the greatest, strongest, most domineering expert out there, which in many ways is what publishers love, understandably. Sometimes folks who come from that point of view have a really huge, you know, platform and can be very persuasive in selling. So I think the publisher was just interested in that idea. There was a lot of real personal interest in it. And I know that they had really liked my prior books. And so they were kind of a fan of my work, which makes a difference having a couple of books under, you know, under me. So I was super, super thankful to them.
Let's talk a little bit about positioning and white space, because it can be really hard to find the white space, especially when it's a crowded market, right? When there are a lot of books out there that your concept is competing with. Mm. How hard was that for you in terms of like finding the white space? And you can talk to any of of your books. Publishers get really excited when they see that there's sort of an intersection between your concept and the white space, right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that. Like, was it just like an aha moment for you where you were like, oh my gosh, there's huge white space for this book? Or was it more of a process?
I have a really strong point of view about this. And it's just standing in my own sovereignty in terms of my work, because I am an author practitioner. I don't choose ideas to write about because they're ideas that are in white space or I can see can be positioned. I write about the things that I know my clients need. And I know that I bring a specific point of view in the work that I do over so many years, where I, because of bringing it out, working with people in person over many, many years, because I'm testing and trying ideas when I'm teaching classes, when I'm doing keynotes, the idea really is one that where I begin to see it and experience it. Like in the case of The Widest Net, it's actually was around 30 years worth of my own body of work. My degree in college was international development, like a whole framework in grassroots economic change. And then we use the method, testing it out live here, building a live brick and mortar community space for BIPOC entrepreneurs. And then I had worked with the idea for many entrepreneurs, and especially entrepreneurs of color, where I was like, this is super interesting that for an idea that's less about centering yourself as that like sole expert, which tends to be in the empire world, generally white males or sometimes white females, not always, but predominantly. It was interesting to me that almost every single one of my clients of color completely resonated with the model because it was more informed by experience of being around my husband's Navajo culture, within the Black community, within the, you know, Latin community. There are all these cultures and communities that really are more collaboratively based. That's really the essence of how they are. So I never had any doubt that it was the right idea and it was a big idea because I had seen it work in the real world with real people. And I noticed the difference when I would come with my framework and point of view to people where they would be like, oh my God, like it, I just feel so like much more grounded and it makes so much more sense and I understand it this way and it's aligned with my values. And so I am not saying whatsoever that it doesn't mean that I'm an expert, which one has to be per our earlier discussion, at demonstrating to somebody that it is a big idea. That's really that sales component. I think about Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point, you know, of being a salesperson, you know, maven salesperson or connector. I'm definitely like a connector maven. And so I can be very sure of an idea, but I don't always have the wisdom to know how to describe that. But I have never, ever doubted the veracity of the ideas in the book because I write ideas that work in the real world. That's my own standard is, yeah. Do I believe them? Have people paid me their hard-earned money in order to utilize them? And do they work?
Yeah. Yeah. So you've lived it for 30 years and you've seen it actually help people and move the needle for their businesses, right? And their communities. I love that.
Yeah, that's incredible. So when you're doing the actual writing, are you imagining yourself writing to, I call it your muse, you know, or your avatar? Like, who are you writing to specifically? And how do you work with the tension of, you know, you said that your book comes because it's a calling. It's deeply personal. It's cosmic. So what that tension between, you know, what's coming up inside of you and then you communicating to a specific audience?
It's always my clients. And I know, I'm curious what your point of view is. I know there's very wise advice often just to be writing to a very specific person when it is that you're writing a book, just to keep a certain consistency of voice. It's hard for me, I think, to just focus on one person. I tend to think about writing to somebody who is my ideal client. And I often use examples in my books of real live clients or partners, people that I know, to illustrate the points, to really bring it home. But so on one hand, I'm thinking about the person who I usually most care about helping, which in my practice and the work that I do is generally a woman of color business owner who has an amazing big idea and really wants to get it out in the world and wants to feel really grounded in doing that. And I have very specific examples of clients that I work with. And then I always want to make my best friend Desiree Attaway proud. And I always want to make my dad proud, even though he's no longer on the earth. My dad was a writer and a photographer. And my sister as well. My sister's a writer and an editor. So I think I always have them as more the literary standard. Yep. Desiree is more my like values. Am I really writing something that is meaningful and not harmful and something that's really going to be helpful? And I don't show them until it's done. I'm one of those, I admire people who are like, let me share my book idea with 100 readers. Now, that probably would make my book 1,000 times better. So I'm not knocking that method, but it does not work for me as a writer. I really have to first get that whole idea out and then in the hands of an editor. That's a very like sacred relationship that I have where we can start to work the idea. And then, of course, I get excited about bringing it forward.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. You know, a lot of women specifically struggle with this idea of being an imposter, right? This whole imposter syndrome situation. You don't strike me as someone who you don't present in a way that one might think that that's something you're struggling with. You certainly have so much experience. We'd love to hear you just talk about that, because the journey to becoming an author where you have your authority, if you will, mining and leveraging that expertise into a book is something that a lot of women struggle with. So we'd love to hear you just tell us a little bit about your perspective on that.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that I know you know is imposter syndrome is actually not real. So it is not,
indeed,
it is a social construct. And to me, when I look at it, I analyze it as there are major systemic forces that are constantly socializing us as women. And again, we look at it from an intersectional perspective. And it gets deeper and stronger if you're a Black woman, Indigenous woman, et cetera, where there are all kinds of messages constantly coming at us that we are, our ideas are not as strong as men, that we don't have, you know, as strong ideas, all those kinds of things. And so there's one thing that I think is super important to recognize when one is writing a book, especially if one's writing a book that in some ways is criticizing those overall systems. It is a real fear that people have. And I think the risk is different to different people. I have much less risk as a white woman to be writing certain ideas that might critique more like the dominant male kind of patriarchal perspective on business because of my identity as a white woman. So I think there is true grounded fear when one is bringing forth an idea that might be pushing against the ideas that are dominant, where you can get a whole bunch of pushback depending upon who you ask about whether or not the idea is good enough. Again, that kind of feeling that I got when, again, justifiably, because of the way I brought the idea to my publisher,
yep,
they were just like, I don't see this as a big idea. I was like, oh, no, this 100% is a big idea. I know for a fact. But the other side of that, when there are systemic forces that are constantly coming saying, you know, you're not good enough, it better be good, it better be perfect. If you get this deal, then you're really, you know, you need to demonstrate you're just as good as everybody else. It's where it has to match the actual, your own body of work, your framework, your approach, your own expertise. People can write fantastic books. People can be great writers. I think about Dan Pink, a Gretchen Rubin, people who are more journalists that do obviously do a deep dive for whatever topic that they choose. But like for Dan, who happens to be a friend of mine, you know, he's written about regret. He's written about time. He's written about drive and performance, because he will choose ideas that, because he's a smart guy, he knows are going to be big speaking topics that are relevant, but also ideas that he's willing to wrestle with for a good period of time. And there's a specific approach to how it is that he builds the case for the book that's part of the writing journey. So that is the work of an author. Either you're really drawing on your own experience and body of work, which is never going to be uniquely enough, right? But then you're also very deliberate about what is really the framework that can make you feel comfortable,
yeah,
knowing that you're representing the idea in a good way. And there can be many ways that you're bringing the ideas out and testing them in the real world, getting feedback. A number of my clients who are authors go through a very rigorous process of making sure that they get feedback, like for different frameworks as they're writing the book. But to me, when you look at both parts of it, and I know it's very coachy of me to say it, but language is extremely powerful. And so where we tell ourselves something like, ooh, I'm feeling uncomfortable about this book, I must have imposter syndrome because it's not true, and just do the research, especially for women of color, then you can be very precise and say, I feel nervous to bring this idea out in the world because I know it's probably going to piss off some of my white male friends. Or I'm nervous because I'm writing a book and I realize I don't have 10 years of experience in this topic like another author does. Right. And I want to make sure that I am respectful in the book of making sure I feel good about the content.
Yes.
That is precise language that will help you do things to make your book better, because you all know better than anybody, it's so much work in order to make sure that you have a really strong book, not only if it's a nonfiction book, right? That it actually is like tested, it works, it's based on real ideas, but also that it's interesting to read and, you know, a sticky idea and framed right and all those kind of things. But I think it's really important that we take back some of the language.
Yep.
And I have seen it real time and experienced it. There is gender bias in publishing. Hardcore. Oh, yeah. Women who have amazing ideas, who can have huge platforms. And then again, like, no knock against an individual white male. Like, I'm related, obviously, right, to many of them. And I have many, many dear friends who are white males. But I will admit that I just sort of get pretty ragey sometimes when I can see somebody saunter in that might just have a whole bunch of, you know, Twitter followers or something like that, who is automatically believed more that they have expertise, as opposed to a woman that actually has either researched, you know, background or experience background.
Yeah, it's interesting too, like hearing you talk about the nerves that we can feel around putting a book out into the world. The other thing that many authors feel nervous about is, do they have a big enough platform? Do they have a big enough author platform? Because publishers do put a lot of pressure on us as authors, right, to market the book. So I'd love to hear from, you know, your own experience, like even if we go back to like your first book, Escape from Cubicle Nation, what did your platform look like at that point? Like, how did you, and tell us a little bit about, like, with the actual selling then of the book, the marketing of the book, what do you think was the most effective channel for you?
Well, I think it was very different just given the way that I got the deal. I think the, you know, what they were looking at that time was the platform of my blog, because it was, I did have a lot of followers. I'm not somebody who has like a strong, it's like, you know, the neighborhood party that's kind of full to the gills, but it's not the person that rents out the local event hall, you know, or like the stadium full of people. I think one of the unique things about my own platform, because of the work that I do, is it's not just, I think, the size of my platform, but I am very friendly and I know many, many people, and I work with many people who also have really large platforms, and I'm a connector and somebody who partners a lot. And so a lot of the strategies, I think it was something that was significant to the publisher, where I was friends with Guy Kawasaki and, you know, and Seth Godin. And at that time, people who I had met through blogging, who I know for a fact did put in a good word for me, that in many ways is, you know, positioning that they could be using their own platforms as well in order to promote the books. And that definitely has been the case through the years. Mm-hmm. Gosh, I can't even remember. That was so long ago. It was like 2007, you know, when that happened with it. So I don't know like how many blog followers that I had, but I look at it a couple different ways, because in many ways, like, I understand how the publishers need to have some kind of objective metrics that they're looking for in order to have some level of comfort to know that people are going to be, you know, extending their work. It's also really important that those often, like, people might do specific campaigns in order to boost up the number of Instagram followers that they have, for example, right? Or get a bunch of people on their newsletter list that can really have nothing to do with the actual, their ability to move books. They're two totally different things of like how many followers you have and your ability to be moving books. Mm-hmm. So it is the responsibility of us as authors, when we get a book deal, to be doing the sales and marketing activities in order to make sure that our book, you know, is really selling copies and moving. But it is something I think that's really important to also realize, is I see people investing a huge amount of money and effort and energy into just building their platform, which again, I would look at the trade-off given the kind of publishing path that you want. If you want a traditional deal, in many ways, you have just to be showcasing these traditional means in which you are demonstrating that you have platform. But I would just say, you know, like, of the followers, you know, who actually is there? Who can you pick up and call? that is likely to be having you on their podcast or, you know, inviting you on their stage or something like that.
I love what you said about really like your personal connections and people in your life, whether they're friends, family members, colleagues, who themselves have big platforms and who want to be helpful to you, right? They want to see your book be a success. In every book proposal that I've written, I always, in my marketing section, I always list those people out, right? Because I want the publisher to know that I'm making a commitment to reach out to these people and to ask for their help. So I think it is something really important. It's not just the number of followers. It's not just how big your platform is, but what are those relationships that you have where you can almost like borrow influence?
Yeah. And it is to say also then for the actual folks that you have in your community, people that are on your newsletter list or that you have and follow on social media. I mean, that's the true, that is where the true connections are. And I think that's where the real movement is, where you do have people as individual readers that are really willing to go out there and be passionate about the books and to be sharing it and to be writing reviews. That's always been another really important thing. I've always been, again, like having a little bit larger size dinner party of actual like friends. I don't just count people as like fans or followers, like many people I've known for 18, 20 years, and they've really stood behind me along the entire journey and are very passionate about it. And I think that that makes a big difference as well.
So in your book, The Widest Net, there were two concepts that really stood out for me, watering holes and TMAs. And I would love for you to talk about both of those as they relate to your marketing plan for The Widest Net. Like, how did you leverage watering holes and TMAs?
So the high level concept in versus having an empire where you're basically just trying to, you know, blast the signal so you get as many people as possible to come to you when you're trying to sell books. Concept of The Widest Net is you have your ideal reader, in this case, in the center of an ecosystem, where they're looking at places in person and online for information, resources, tools, and support to solve the problem that your book also solves. So my readers all want to grow their business. And generally, with ethics and in a way that's collaborative and not like hardcore internet marketing. So the concept of a watering hole is within, I have 10 different segments of the ecosystem wheel in the book. So as you look at these different places where there are other people, like a podcast, you might have a very popular podcast, I would call it a watering hole, where the lovely hosts have done tons of work to gather essentially ideal readers for your book in the audience that follows that podcast. So when you show up and you're a guest on that specific podcast, it's one to many, a perfect point of connection. Or you have an event that is a watering hole. Events are really the super connector thing, which is why it was so hard for people like myself to be promoting books during the shutdown, is you have the opportunity during an event, your fellow presenters often and speakers on stage can be these wonderful, I call them peanut butter and jelly partners, highly complimentary, non-competitive partners. Your audience are often ideal readers. And then the sponsors can be people that have companies that often serve your customers. So those are examples. I do a lot of work with brands, and brands are also wonderful ways. Most large brands that have, for example, small business customers as their audience use content marketing. I did actually Tiny Marketing Actions webinars with GoDaddy, for example, when I was promoting The Widest Net, where I reached out to them to do a webinar on the topic. They pulled a few thousand of their customers to that webinar, and I was able to promote the ideas. So that's kind of the idea of watering holes, specific places in person and online where other wonderful people have gathered your ideal audience together. So it's your job to be connecting there as a marketing strategy. And then the idea of tiny marketing actions is that's actually the way in which you do build connections. It's often in small ways when you strategically know, for example, which podcast you'd love to be on. If it's a popular one, for example, there may be some things you'd need to do in order to lead up to that. So you need to be following it. You might, you know, get to know the guests. You might do things to build up your own platform so that you position yourself as somebody that has a topic that the hosts are really interested in learning about. But it really is a way that you build in these small habits into your day-to-day life and work because you have done a strategic analysis about the best places to connect. that ends up being a more authentic way, I think, of building a business, as opposed to just, we've all gotten, you know, hammered by, you know, some big pitch by usually a, you know, nameless, faceless, very kind PR person who's just blanketing the world trying to get their author, you know, on your podcast or something. And it just rarely works because it just feels so disingenuous versus, you know, I just got an email from somebody, a professor of at the London School of Economics. I think it's like The Theory of Everyone or something, some like cool sounding book. Mm-hmm. And he reached out personally and was like, you know, I just thought you might be interested in this book. And it was just delightful. It's like, oh, you're super cool in London School of Economics. And yeah, send me a book. And it was such a highly relational way that who knows, it could be super fun to have him on the podcast, on my own podcast, mm-hmm. once I read the book and connect with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun to connect all the dots, mm-hmm. right? For sure.
So one of the specific ways that I use that idea of like watering holes and tiny marketing actions during the Widest Net launch is it was kind of meta where I invited a group of folks that were from my own audience to follow along. We did it probably maybe the 8 or 10 weeks before the launch where I knew all of them because they're all business owners. We're all interested in learning behind the scenes about ways to connect. And I was sharing ideas from the book in real time to be giving them ideas for how it is that they would be launching their books or their programs or whatever. And also I brought in folks from the book. So different people who I had featured in the book and different case studies where I brought them in to have conversations with everybody. So they're really doing a deep dive. Mm. And in this case, it was like creating my own watering hole, but a place where I already had people who were connected with me that were having the live experience of really understanding the method real time. And then also I was able to be very deliberate with them saying, this is one of the ways that I'm using it when the book comes out. And then I could be very specific about ways that they could be supporting the launch. And I was just trying to contrast it with sometimes just that, you know, join my street team. Mm-hmm. And the whole premise is just you help me, you know, do well. And like, I love that. You need to have reciprocity. But I'm always thinking like, what's really in it for the readers themselves? Besides being kind and generous and helping out the author. Mm-hmm. And that's how I'd like to build things in a little bit differently.
Yeah, creating value, right? Mm-hmm. Creating value for them.
It's also really great to think about this in terms of aspiring authors who think of platform and network and someone like you, Pam, as being so separate from them and something to aspire to. And the idea of, excuse me, of the watering hole in this ecosystem is that you can start today by engaging with authors and by being on the giving side. You know, don't wait until you have a big ask. Get involved now and really start engaging with the people that you admire, who you long to become.
It's so true. And always when it's coming from that good, genuine perspective, I always think just the best partners and anybody who it is that you really aspire to be like, whose work you admire, is usually because you are aligned in terms of values and you totally respect their body of work and think it's really cool. To me, that's the only way. If you're only looking at like who has a really huge audience, it's not the right thing to look for.
Right.
But a tiny marketing action, one example, I have lots of recipes, tiny marketing action recipes. And one of them is when you see that one of your favorite authors is going to be visiting your city, reach out and say, hey, I'm in Mesa, Arizona. I see you're coming to Phoenix in January. Is there anything I can do as kind of on the ground in order to be helpful?
I love that.
And that could be anything. Like, could I bring you your favorite coffee? Could I tell all my friends? Could I do a special thing? And that is something that authors appreciate so much, to show up and be generous. Yeah. And, you know, the key is not to then get there, meet them and be like, hey, would you, you know, write the foreword to my book or would you promote mine? One of the biggest lessons, it was from Guy Kawasaki, because we did a panel at South by Southwest. After I got my book deal, we did a blog to book deal panel at South by, because at the time there were a whole number of people who had had that experience. Stephanie Klein was another author who was on our panel. And somebody had asked him a question in the audience and they were like, what do you do in order to get the attention of an influencer, somebody who could make a difference like Guy had done for me when I was like totally unknown with zero platform. And I shared my blog post to him in a tiny marketing action, right? Just taking the risk to reach out because I thought he might like it.
Yep.
And he said, you know, a lot of people might think that I have the Midas touch, like everything I touch turns to gold. He said, they have it wrong. I only touch gold.
Wow. Interesting.
So that was really important for me to hear, and I've told that story so many times, that is that responsibility. When we think about that author responsibility, of you can have lots of people in your ecosystem, the ecosystem of people providing support, resources, information to your clients. You want to be showing up no matter the size of your platform. Everybody is just maybe a little bit less experienced equal, or an equal that has maybe a smaller platform, but you want to feel really strong and secure that what you're sharing is something that you're proud of, that you've worked hard on, that's useful.
Yeah.
And in my experience, that over and over and over again, I think that's the thing that ends up creating a really significant, interesting connection, because you're actually talking about the thing you both care about, which is really who your clients are and like, what are those problems you're trying to solve? And you can really be sharing interesting points of view. And then, you know, through the years, like just exactly as you said, reach out and be very proactive. I'm always reaching out to Guy and, you know, like, hey, you should have now, and these days he has a podcast, you know, doesn't really blog anymore, but you know, you should have this person on Remarkable People, John Legend. I'm always trying to get him to interview John Legend so I can go and be there in the studio when he does it.
That's so great.
Yeah. But you know, those are ways just to be, my friend Susan Beyer calls it being relentlessly helpful, you know, just like constantly showing up and looking for that reciprocity. And then when you do have a relationship, you can take a risk when there is an ask to make, like, would you blurb my book? I always like to have a very specific clause where I say, you know, I thought about you because I know in your body of work, I thought you'd be an amazing person to blurb the book. Mm-hmm. If for any reason this is not a fit for you, you can absolutely tell me, no questions asked.
Yeah.
If you are open to it, then here you go.
Right.
Because it gets kind of fuzzy when you are friends with lots of people. And if people are blurbing appropriately, they're putting their name on something that they feel like is gold. And you never want to just assume, you know, hey, we've been buddies for a long time. I've done a bunch of stuff for you. Therefore, you have to be supporting me in my book.
Yeah. No, that's great.
That's true. And there's so many different ways you can show up for people. Like you said, I mean, even writing an Amazon review and sending it to an author, you know, sending a link to the Amazon review that you wrote. There are, you know, lots of smaller things that can make a big impact, right? So I think that's your whole concept of tiny marketing actions, which I love. They just feel very doable. And as long as you're doing it with your heart and you're doing it genuinely, right? And not just like, I'm doing this for you, so then you're going to do me a favor. It works and it feels good, right?
That's right. That's really like the spiritual practice part of it, you know, that's just it, really and truly, and this is probably the hardest work to do. You know that to build a relationship from nothing into one in which you're friendly enough to be asking a significant maybe question or favor, very often we have to start so much earlier, like you said, following somebody's work, being helpful, getting to know them, really seeing if there's a vibe there. It's kind of like dating. Thank God I haven't had to date in 20 years married, but you know, it's kind of that same thing. You really want to take some time to make sure that there's mutual benefit, you know, that the person is not just sort of passing time and you notice that they're actually interested in you and your body of work. And then when it is time to make the ask, you want to feel emboldened, like to make an ask. The main posture of tiny marketing actions is where you have that instinct, like I did at 10 o'clock that night in 2006 to email Guy Kawasaki, you know, who I'd never met, who I thought was amazing and I admired so much. Like when you have that instinct just to do it with joy and love, and then to be completely okay with whatever happens, just to release total desire for expectations. And it's really that habit of taking consistent actions and planting multiple seeds where things start to pop up. The thing where all of us have gotten stuck is just normal, is, you know, continually refreshing your email to wait for that one person who you asked to finally come back and connect with you. And it just, you're going to slow everything down if you do it. So be very passionate and deliberate. Be clear when you ask questions, but always give a very specific out so that they can just feel clear if they say no. And then keep planting seeds. Keep planting seeds.
I love that. And not attached to the outcome, because you don't know what the outcome is going to be.
Right.
That's great. One of my favorite ideas from your books is this idea of a person's root mission. Could you talk to us a little bit about how your root mission has evolved over your career?
I kind of do reflection at different times in my own body of work to really think about why I'm doing what I'm doing. There's one thread that the subtitle for Body of Work was finding the thread that ties your story together. So it's sort of like that's always the context that I'm looking for as I'm getting into new stages of work. The stage that I'm in right now is I have an agency helping people build licensing and certification programs, sort of a more mature business approach to taking IP and sharing it. And so I was looking back, like, what is that thread between doing something like that, all the work I've done around marketing or community lab we've had here for 7.5 years. And a lot of it really comes back to, as it usually does, a childhood experience of being 5 years old when my parents split. My dad was mayor of our town at the time, our little town of San Anselmo. It was super traumatic, I know, for everybody all the way around, especially my mom. It was very financially insecure. So we went from like, right, your dad's the mayor. You know, I was super close and remained close with my dad, thankfully, after the divorce. But I'll never forget that feeling, and especially seeing my mom struggle so much, of being financially insecure in that overall feeling of like, we were so lucky that we had such dear family friends. They did not let us fail. That's really the metaphor in the widest net. Is not a net to like pull in the fish to you. It's actually like a net underneath mm-hmm. those that you care about, mm-hmm. where it's like, no matter what happens, I'm not going to let you fall. And the more that we can be building really strong bodies of work, networks, connections, things that will make it much less likely that we will fail, because we all know business is hard. Weird stuff happens in the economy, yeah. right? Like there's no way you can be 100% that your specific business direction will work. But if you fail in one area, do you have people you can call if you need to jump into a job? You know, do you have all of the skills that you need to really be holding this very fresh, you know, rooted connection? And I think the way it fits into my, you know, point of view, my politics and my values, my top two values are justice is my number one and love is the second one. And so it goes all the way deep down just into, you know, systemic inequity and really wanting to be totally shifting, you know, this really just harsh, terrible dynamic of power and domination and control that impacts so many amazing people in the world. So for me, it just goes like way down in a root of believing in transformational change, and that I, you know, in order to do my work, I have to believe that change is possible. I do believe we can change. Mm-hmm. As much as ideas are really big, but it's like the, you know, canvas, if you will, that I paint on. It happens to be the world of business, and it happens to be around like economic security. Mm. How can just people feel more supported? And if things mess up, which they always do, how can you just make sure that you have people around you that have your back and that you're utilizing the kinds of methods and approaches that will make it much less likely that you're going to have to fall too far before you start to go back up.
I love that. So what's, do you have a sense of what the next book is going to be?
It's funny, you know, I'm not a, there are two. So very unusually, really soon after The Widest Net came out, usually, as I said, it's like a 5 to 7 year process where I sort of wait for that whisper. Very, very soon after it came out, I got a whisper for a book that I'm calling Make Good Choices, which is what my best friend Desiree said to her girls every morning before they left for school. Mm-hmm. I think as my kids are getting older, they're teenagers. My son's in college. My daughter's a junior in high school. And I thought one of the biggest things that I do besides just help people build their business, their IP, and build their market and sell their stuff is to help them navigate decisions, and especially decisions that are like in an ethical framework. How do I decide like, what tactic to use, or should I partner with this person, or should I take this job or not? So I thought, first, it feels like more a book that I would want to write for my kids and really to just codify what my point of view is, because I do feel really proud. I've taken a non-traditional route in many ways. I've had very specific metrics that I've looked at where I haven't necessarily looked to build, you know, the hugest business or the biggest platform. But I'm so proud of the way that I've done it, where I know that I have this just super engaged audience and people whose lives I've touched through my work that just makes me feel peaceful right at night where I can sleep. And it doesn't mean I can't grow, which I'm excited to really grow and expand now that my kids are older and go in a new direction. But so that's one that I'm not exactly sure maybe I'll just write it for them initially, like for them as the ideal reader, and just write it very directly and then see if I zoom it out. It would be probably a little bit more of a self-helpy thing, because it's not like a treatise like Dan Pink would do about, you know, the anatomy of decisions and an analysis of all the decision-making framework. Like, that's not really what it is. I think it's probably this combination of like encouragement and just grounded advice. There's a nickname that I've run from for many years publicly, but it's very sweet. Personally, a lot of younger folks that have been clients in the past call me Auntie Pam. So it's sort of that like auntie, that auntie energy of like, and I'm such a proud auntie. I have so many nieces and nephews, blood related. And then I have I'm kind of the internet, you know, auntie. Right. And I like that feeling. And that's often the kinds of conversations that I have with these younger folks long after we work together, is helping them navigate everything from personal relationships to dealing with grief to, you know, issues with their business and their body of work. So I think that's one. The other one that I'm excited by is more like Architects of Liberatory Change. So this is the way that I describe my clients. And when I think about the advice I often give to my clients, is you want to be writing a book that is directly related to the business that you have if you're wanting to be if you're not independently wealthy. So I'm super passionate and excited by the intelligent design of IP, ways that we actually create really effective methods and models, and the way that we actually bring ideas to life. And I think it would be really fun. It would be wise to do that. I don't feel like at this stage that it would necessarily be like a big five publisher book. I might take a path like with my dear friends at Page Two, you know, who I do a lot of work with. A lot of my clients do publishing there, as an example of just maybe it's something that I really see more specifically as related to my own body of work. But I'm not itching to start writing right away. But I will say the Make Good Choices, maybe it'll start a little bit more like a manifesto-y kind of thing.
Okay, Pam, I want that book. I want
Do
Make
you?
Good Choices.
What hits you? You're the expert. What do you think?
No, I'm literally sitting here going, because we, with my kids, they're 11 and 13. We talk about this all the time. The choices that you make, the choices that you make, right? And the impact that they have. And so I love this concept so much. I want this book. I want to be able to sit with them and like read it with them. I have to tell you, I think this is like the perfect moment to wrap up this amazing conversation. I'm just so grateful. And Bethany, I'm sure I speak on your behalf, to have you on the podcast. And thank you so much for sharing all of your incredible wisdom and your experiences and your insights and all the incredible content from your book. We are just so, so, so grateful to you. And before you sign off, can you please share with our listeners, where can they find you? Where can they learn more about you? And, you know, where can they connect with you?
So you can find me at PamelaSlim.com. That's where I have everything there. You follow my podcast, which is the Whitest Net podcast. And anything I'm doing is usually over there. I am on social media. It's probably the best place to connect, kind of worky connections, over on LinkedIn. I don't know how you all are, but I've started to really gravitate more towards LinkedIn. Yeah. For a long time, I didn't get it. But in recent years, I've really been enjoying it because, again, we can kind of have more of a deep conversation about the nature of work. So that's a good place to reach out and connect. And then I always say on Instagram, I'm like not strategic. It's a mix of like kids, dogs, community stuff, and then like business things that happen. So I'm Pam Slim over there if you want to connect.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Thanks, Pam.
Thank you for joining us on Bookbound.
If you like what you heard, please subscribe and rate and review us on your favorite podcast listening platform.
Please visit us at bookboundpodcast.com for more on us and how we work with authors.